So I served for about 12 years in ministry and local work before I went out on my own full-time with this seminar. And for 3 of those 12 years, I served as an education minister. And obviously, one of my responsibilities was to recruit new people to teach Bible classes. And so as I would talk to people about their willingness to teach a class, and as they would shoot me down with things like, no, under no circumstances, no. As one person so eloquently put it, he said, the day that I teach for you, you'll be able to hear the sizzle of the snowflake against the eternal flame. Okay. As I would talk to people about why they were unwilling to teach, one of the more common objections that it wasn't the most common, but one of the more common objections that I received, one I was totally not prepared for, was quite simply people did not know how to prepare a lesson and deliver it. They had no training whatsoever. And this is where the seeds of Teaching Rocket were first planted in my mind, the realization that in the church, we do not train our Bible class teachers. We offer no training whatsoever. In fact, I joke in these seminars that in the church, we have 2 main requirements to teach a Bible class. Number 1, have a pulse. Number 2, do not be a complete and utter moron. And we will fudge on one of those if we're desperate enough. So I want to go through kind of the nuts and bolts of preparing a lesson from scratch and delivering it. Now, if you are frustrated because you feel like, you know, this was too short, I wish we could have gone into depth on developing a lesson, preparing it, I'm with you. We could have an entire seminar just on preparing a lesson, forget delivering it. But we don't have that kind of time, so we're going to have just a bird's eye view of the process of preparing a Bible class lesson from scratch. Here we go. Number 1, ask the question, what is the series objective? What is the series objective? Every series of lessons needs to have an objective. And no, I am not talking about an objective statement such as to study the book of Jeremiah. That's not what I'm talking about. You need to have a really good idea of what you want to accomplish with the series of lessons. 2 years ago, I wrote material on the book of Ephesians for the church I was at, and I came up with this objective statement for the series: to celebrate and discuss the implications of being insiders in God's family. Because that's really what Ephesians is about. The first half talks about how great it is that we're in Christ, and the second half of the book talks about, okay, here's how you live as if it's so. So again, you need to have a clear distinction or an idea of exactly what you want to accomplish with this series of lessons. Number 2, you need to ask, what is the lesson's objective? What is the lesson's objective? Every lesson needs to have an objective. Because you and I have sat in on lessons and sermons and thought to ourselves, I have no idea what that lesson was supposed to be about. And I don't think the teacher knew what that lesson was supposed to be about. You want to have a clear idea of what you want your lesson to be about. You want to be careful about being too broad or too narrow in your objective statement. Be careful about being too broad or too narrow. If you are too narrow, then you're going to burn through your material in 20 minutes and have to make awkward chit-chat until the bell rings. If you are too broad, you're going to be all over the place, very undisciplined. I sat in on an auditorium adult class one time. Teacher taught the class. He opened it up with, today we're going to talk about faith. And I remember thinking, no, you're not. Not in 45 minutes, you're not. Way too broad. So be careful about being too broad or too narrow. Number 3, you need to ask the question, who is my audience? Who is my audience? I think about this primarily in terms of the age of my audience, because the age of your audience will impact several things, such as illustration, application, vocabulary. I remember teaching a group of teenagers several years ago, and I made a reference to the Back to the Future movies. And I got a bunch of blank stares. And I thought, oh, come on! And then I had a youth minister friend of mine last summer. He was teaching the senior high school kids, 11th, 12th grade. He made a reference to The Lion King. And he got a bunch of blank stares. And he thought, you have got to be kidding me, until he realized every child in that room had been born after that movie came out in theaters. So be aware of the age of your audience. But it's not just the age. What are some other demographic details that you're going to want to keep in mind about your audience besides their age? What are some other demographic factors that you're going to want to keep in mind about your audience besides their age?
Their education.
Okay, level of education. Very good. So I grew up in rural Mississippi, in rural congregations, and it was always a turnoff when big city preachers would come to town for like a gospel meeting.
and use big words. We didn't know what they meant. Now, it didn't mean we were stupid, okay? But I found that to be a little bit condescending. And so one of the things that I am sensitive to from my background, one of the things I'm sensitive to is I don't want to use words that might possibly make my audience feel stupid. I don't want that to happen. I'm very sensitive to that. I always execute it perfectly, but that's what I shoot for. Now, obviously, if we're in a college town where there's a bunch of PhDs in the audience, we can be a little bit more expansive with our vocabulary, but I want to be sensitive to the level of education of my audience. So, excellent point. What else?
Culture.
Culture, very good. Everything from things that have happened recently in the community to the way things are in there, because obviously the church in Colorado and the church back in the Southeast is very, very different. So I want to be respectful of that. When I was in New Zealand, one of the fun things for me was to figure out what were elements of my seminar that I had to adapt a little bit or tweak a little bit because the culture there is different than it is here. One thing I learned was I couldn't talk about when I was in college because college to them is sort of a in-between between a junior college and high school. It's not what we typically think of. If I meant what we would think of as college, I had to say university. When I was in university, people don't really talk like that now or here, but again, I had to be respectful of that. Also, in just a few minutes, I'm going to have a slide and you're going to look at it and you're going to think, huh, that's pretty funny. He could have said that in New Zealand. Well, I'll point it out when I come to it, but yeah, I had to explain what it meant. It was a turn of phrase that we have here in the U.S. that they didn't have down there. Other demographic factors?
Men or women?
Gender is a big one. So I love it when people mention gender, so here's my story. Several years ago when I was preaching, I was asked to teach the ladies' Bible class that met during the week. And I was very excited about that prospect. And I studied hard, prepared, and I got to tell y'all, I presented what very easily could be the greatest ladies' Bible class lesson that has ever been presented. I rocked it, I killed it. Even God was impressed with my lesson. Little old lady was walking out and she said, remember that this is a ladies' Bible class, not so much on the sports metaphors. Talk about me crashing to earth and burning. I mean, that really was a good gut check for my ego. And that's not to say that women don't like sports, but again, you knew what she was talking about. And so that was something that very clearly I had not been sensitive to was the gender of my audience. It was all women. So yeah, excellent point. Anything else? There was one big one nobody's mentioned yet.
We have to think about their level of knowledge.
Okay, very good. So think about their level of spiritual maturity. And then under that umbrella, let's leave several things, including their level of biblical literacy, how long they've been in the church, whether or not they were raised in the church. You know, if I'm teaching adults, but maybe most of them were converts from when they were growing up as kids, I want to know about that because I can't necessarily make jokes about 728B and they know what I'm talking about. So that idea of level of spiritual maturity, as you mentioned, there are several things underneath that umbrella. I want to try and get a good handle on exactly who my audience is and think through all of the demographic factors related to them. However, while still doing due diligence to these three questions, I need to move to number four as quickly as possible, and that is, what does the Bible have to say about this? And now it is time in the seminar where I'm going to give you the most important piece of advice that you're going to get out of this seminar. Are y'all ready? I'm about to give you the most valuable advice you'll get out of everything we talk about today. Here it is. You need to read the text multiple times. There is no other piece of advice I can give you that will make you a better Bible class teacher than you getting in the habit of reading the text multiple times. And I'm talking about 10, 20, 30, 40 times if necessary. Read the text multiple times. It's a lot like watching a favorite movie that you've seen up to a number of times, and yet every time you watch it, you still catch stuff you've never seen before. Do we have any John Wayne fans in the audience? John Wayne fans, okay. All right, a couple of you are going to heaven. So I'm a huge John Wayne fan. I grew up a huge John Wayne fan because of my grandparents. My favorite John Wayne film is McClintock. I love that movie. Every time it comes on cable, I have to stop what I'm doing and watching it. I still catch stuff I've never seen before. It's just uncanny. Any of you ever grew up milking a cow? Anybody grew up milking a cow? Okay. So you milk a cow, what happens? You bring that pail of milk in after you milk the cow, you set it down and let it sit for a few minutes. What happens to that pail of milk after a few minutes?
that cream starts to rise to the top of it. The exact same thing happens in Bible study. If you will learn to sit with the text, there's going to be cream that always rises to the top. You'll notice stuff that you've never seen before. There's a gentleman that I know that it is his habit to read through the entire New Testament once every 30 days. He does it 12 times a year. He's been doing this for 25 or 30 years, and he tells me, Michael, there's still things that I catch that I have never seen before in my life. And I think, what a wonderful example that is. So I want you to learn to read the text multiple times. There is no other surefire way to see fantastic insight into the text, insight that most of all of your students will not have. There's no other surefire way to generate that insight than to simply sit down and read through it over and over and over and over and over again. And as you're doing that, write down questions that arise. Write down questions that arise. Let's do a little survey or poll, and please do not be embarrassed to raise your hand on this. If you can raise your hand to this question, you are in very good company. You're in very good company. How many of you are ever plagued or bothered by the perpetual question of, I don't know what I'm going to say when I teach this Bible class. I don't know what I'm going to say. I call it blank paper or blank sheet syndrome. Just you're starting with a blank piece of paper and you just don't know how to start. How many of you are plagued by that on a regular basis? I just don't know how to get started. Okay. If you are plagued by this, and I am at times, this is a great way to get kick-started with your lesson. This is a great way to generate material for your class, because in the way that I teach, half of my lesson is stepping people through the text and explaining all of the weird stuff going on. Because especially in the Old Testament, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. And then the second half of my lesson will be application and discussion. So if you want to be able to almost immediately generate material for half of your lesson, you need to get in the habit of reading the text and writing down questions that you have as you read. And try to get in the frame of mind of, I have never read or heard this story before, because there will be people in your audience that have never read or heard the story before. Take nothing for granted. So I want you to open your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5. And I sat down one day with the story of Naaman in 2 Kings 5. And I wrote down 15 questions that I had as a result of reading through the passage. If you read through the passage and did this exercise, you might come up with very different questions, and that's quite okay. But I sat down and I asked 15 questions of the text. And in my teaching style, I would go about asking and answering these questions with my students for roughly the first half of class and try to weave together a narrative so that they understood what's going on. So here we go. What does commander of the army mean? I can make an educated guess as to what it means, but what exactly was Naaman's role in the military, and what parallels might it have to today in our modern concept of the military? Number two, what was Syria's relationship with Israel? I know it says that they're making raids across the border, but what exactly is in their history? What would the original audience have thought of when they saw Israel and Syria mentioned in the same sentence? Because when you and I think of the U.S. and another country in the same sentence, we think about certain things almost immediately, don't we? There are certain things that came to every single one of your minds when I mentioned U.S. and North Korea, or the U.S. and Russia. We instantly think of certain things. When I mentioned the U.S. and Great Britain, what do you instantly think about? The U.S. and Great Britain, what do you instantly think about?
World War II.
World War II. And more specifically,
Churchill.
Okay. How many of you thought of something along those lines? Maybe allies, friends, raise your hand. How many of you instantly thought something along those lines? Okay. So as politely as I can, let me ask this question. What is wrong with you people? why does your mind instantly go there? I don't care. Why did your mind go there? Some of you need to learn to be more patriotic. And especially some of you need to learn how to hold a grudge for longer than 200 years. Now, I'm being sarcastic, obviously. However, I love this dynamic, because in every seminar I ask that question, and everyone's response immediately is usually allies and World War II and all of those things. That's not what I instantly think of. I instantly think of the Revolutionary War. And it's, again, because I love my country more than you do. That's right. Never forget.
We won.
Twice. Twice. Here's my point on this.
I use that as an illustration to say, make sure you're in the right time period. Because you, if you had asked this question 200 years ago, do you think anybody would have said allies? Of course not. You would not believe how many times I see people make that mistake, that they're in the wrong time period. Because relationships between countries changes. If you ask my grandmother what she thinks of when she thinks of the U.S. and Japan, guess what she's going to say? World War II. She had a brother that died in the war. When you ask me what I think of when I think of the U.S. and Japan, do you think I say World War II? No. I was born 40 years after they surrendered. I think of great cars. That's just me, okay? My point is that things change rapidly between two nations. I mean, some of you will think I'm a royal idiot when I suggest to you that it's possible that in 20 years, North Korea could be one of our staunchest allies. And you think that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. But you look at other countries that have done an about-face with us in one direction or the other. I mean, think about Rip Van Winkle going to sleep, you know, in 1980, and then he wakes up and he realizes that now Afghanistan is our enemy and Cuba is our ally, whereas then Cuba was our enemy and Afghanistan was our ally. I mean, things change rapidly, so make sure you're in the right time period. What was the nature of leprosy in the Old Testament? How many of you have been told that leprosy was this terrible, horrible, dreaded disease in which your skin turned white, your flesh rotted off, and you had to go away and live in a leper colony? How many of you have been told that? All right. So after this seminar is over today, we are going to have a second special seminar entitled, Let Me Tell You What Amway Has Done For Me. And also, I have some oceanfront property in Arizona I would love to sell to you. What we typically think of as leprosy, skin turns white, flesh rots off, go away and live in a leper colony, that was the leprosy of the New Testament, but that was not the leprosy of the Old Testament. And the way we know that, the leprosy that we think of, that was not known in the ancient world until Alexander the Great brought it, his army brought it back from India. Okay? The word leprosy in Hebrew is a catch-all term for any number of skin diseases, including acne, psoriasis, etc. Did you ever notice in the story, nobody seems to be bothered by hanging out with Naaman? Nobody is yelling, hey, unclean, stay away, quarantine. Nobody's saying that. Might want to explain that to your audience. Why did Syria's king send a letter to Israel's king? Why did Naaman take gifts with him? What do talents and shekels equate to? In other words, how much money are we talking about here? Give me an idea. Why the changes of clothes as gifts? It's odd. Why did the king of Israel respond the way he did? Does he think I'm a god that I have the power of life and death? That becomes relevant to the story. Why did Elisha send a servant to answer the door and not go himself? That's kind of rude where I come from. Why did Naaman look down on the Jordan River? Was there any different significance to him dipping seven times? Those of us who know biblical numerology know that yes, there is. Why did Elisha refuse payment for his services? Here's one I don't remember from the story. Why did Naaman want to take two John Deere tractor loads full of dirt with him back home to Syria? Does anybody remember that part of the story before this morning? Anybody? At the end of the story, he wants to take two mule loads of dirt with him back home. They did not tell me that part of the story in VBS growing up. I remember the calamine lotion simulating leprosy, but I do not remember this part of the story. Number 14, what was the house of Rimmon? And number 15, why did Elisha give his blessing to Naaman to continue worshiping in the pagan temple? There is this very odd scene that at the very end of the story, Naaman comes up and says, okay, I'm a big God fan now. God is number one. I've got my big foam finger. God's number one, big God fan. But when I go home, I'm going to have to continue worshiping in the pagan temple, or it might be off with my head, no more Naaman. What do I do? And Elisha bizarrely says, go in peace. Any of y'all remember that part of the story before this morning? Yeah, they cut that out of the story too when I was in Sunday school growing up. So after I have asked these questions, I want to ask some broader conceptual questions. For example, what purpose did the narrator have for including this story? I wrote this answer down. To demonstrate that God is not just sovereign in Israel, but also in Syria and Babylon, even there God still reigns. Any of you ever take a literature class in high school or college? Anybody? Okay, so you're familiar with asking the question, what is the agenda of the author? That's exactly what we're getting at here. What is the agenda of the author? What purpose does he have for including the story? Number two, what point would the original audience have discerned from the story? And I wrote down two ideas. Number one, that God loves Gentiles as much as Israelites, and he's not willing that any should perish. Then finally, number three, what point is there for God's people today? And this is where you really get into the area of application. I wrote down eight possible points of application for the story of Naaman. But in a sermon or a Bible class lesson on Naaman, I would not use all eight. I would cherry pick two or three at the most, and that's it. Kurt's going to preach on Naaman tomorrow night. Here are eight possible points of application from the story of Naaman. Number one, the most powerful person in the world can be brought low by the Lord. I want you to look at chapter 5, verse 1 in your Bibles. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. And I want you to see the buildup in Naaman's resume by the author. Do you see that? I want you to see the buildup in Naaman's resume by the author. Do you see all of those superlatives? But then what is the last phrase of the verse?
He was a leper.
But he was a leper. So here's what you have from the author. Build up, build up, build up, build up. Build up, build up, build up, build up. Build up, build up, build up, build up, build up. That's exactly what the narrator is trying to telegraph to us in the way that he organizes his material. The most powerful person in the world can be brought low by the Lord. Number two, a person is most spiritually vulnerable during a personal crisis. And you and I hate that that's the way it is, but that's the way it is. If we had a nickel for everybody we've ever known in ministry that we figured out, he or she is not going to, usually he is not going to have any interest in Christ, salvation, the gospel, the church, baptism. I'm going to have to wait for something bad to happen to them, and then suddenly they're going to be real interested. I hate that that's the way it is, but that's the way it is. Okay? A person is most spiritually vulnerable during a personal crisis. God speaks to us in the context of community. I do not believe that God speaks in an audible voice. I do not believe that God contradicts Scripture or reveals additional revelation. But I am convinced that God speaks to us in the context of community. How many times in this passage does God speak to Naaman directly? It's zero. He never does. But he does speak to Naaman through a slave girl, through prophet's servant, through Elisha himself, through Naaman's own servants. He never speaks to Naaman directly. God speaks to us in the context of community. And here's how. You ever been to church on a Sunday and something was said in a sermon, or maybe in Bible class, maybe in a prayer, a line in one of the songs that was sung, something was said, and you walked out the door going, I really needed to hear that today. Has that ever happened to any of you? What is that? God is speaking to us in the context of community. Number four, God exercises his will through the meek and lowly, not necessarily the high and mighty. I think that we do a disservice to our people when we lead them to believe that God is really only able to work his will in the world through presidents and prime ministers and Supreme Court justices and congressmen and women and senators. And no, biblically, God does most of his work in the world through people in the flyover states, average people like you and me. He can work through presidents and prime ministers, etc. Proverbs says that the heart of the king is like water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it whatever way he wishes. But again, God does most of his work through the meek and lowly, not necessarily the high and mighty. Obedience precedes providence. You and I cannot tap into God's salvation or power or deliverance or cleansing until we have done exactly what God has asked us to do. Would Naaman have been cleansed if he had only dipped five times? What about six? Of course not. Only when he had dipped seven times was he cleansed of his leprosy. God's power or word cannot be bought off or influenced. It possesses a power all its own. I think that's why Elisha refuses payment for his services. You can't buy the power of God. It's not for sale, as Simon discovers in Acts 8. We need physical reminders of what God has done for us in the past. I think that's the significance of the two mule loads of dirt. Naaman wanted to take back with him some soil from the land of Israel to remind him of what God had done for him there. And then finally, conversion is immediate, but maturity is not. Again, at the end of the story, he wants to get permission from Elisha to continue worshiping in the pagan temple. And Elisha bizarrely responds with, go in peace. And I think, well, that's kind of odd for a prophet of God to say. But I think it's because Elisha understood that he could not expect a lifelong pagan polytheist to suddenly understand all of the ins and outs of monotheism after being a convert for a whopping 5 minutes. And so he essentially says to him, go in peace. I'm going to trust that the Lord is going to help you figure this all out in his own time, in his own way. Because again, he understood conversion is immediate, maturity is not. All right, after I have asked my questions of the text, I'm going to go find some answers. And I'm going to consult various resources on the text. Let's talk about some of these resources. You have them listed there in your notes at the bottom of the page. Y'all see that? So let's talk about some of these. First of all, I want to encourage you, every Christian needs to be building a good Bible study library at home. Every Christian needs to be building a good Bible study library at home. And the good news, a lot of these books can be purchased for pennies on the dollar if you will buy used books. I'm a big fan of used books. I don't know if y'all have got a good used bookstore in Windsor or Fort Collins or in Denver. I know that you can buy a lot of great used books online via Amazon and other places. So search around, you get some great deals, sometimes paying only 20% of the full retail price, maybe even less. But let's talk about a couple of these. Number one, you've got your topical resources. An oldie but a goodie is Knave's Topical Bible. If you want to find all the verses in the Bible that deal with the flood or God's patience or what have you, whatever topic, this would be a great place to start. But also, everybody needs to have a good Bible dictionary available at home. I'm a huge fan of Unger's Bible Dictionary, but there are several other good ones out there. I also like Baker's Illustrated Bible Dictionary. These will retail for about $40, but sometimes you can find them used for about $20. Any of you familiar with CBD.com, Christian Book Distributors? Sometimes they will have ridiculously fantastic sales on some of these reference books where the corner is nicked or there's a little ink spot on a page that doesn't affect the readability at all, but you'll have some slightly, they say damaged, I wouldn't call it damaged, I'd call it just a boo-boo here and there. But you can find great deals on some of these on these websites. But everybody needs to have a good Bible dictionary at home. You've also got your word study resources. These are resources that will help you learn the definition of Hebrew and Greek words, but it does not require you to know Hebrew or Greek, and these resources are valuable. Famous one for a long time was Vine's Expository Dictionary, but it has been surpassed in recent years by both Mounts and Wren's Expository Dictionaries. I'm a big fan of Mounts Expository Dictionary. It'll retail for about $25 or so. Hard to find a used copy because it is still pretty new. But it's a good one. And then finally, you've got your textual resources, your commentaries on the text. If you only buy one book off this list, it needs to be the IVP Bible Background Commentary on the Old Testament. And there's also a volume on the New, but the IVP Bible Background Commentary on the Old Testament. IVP simply refers to the publisher, InterVarsity Press. This book will retail for about $25. You can buy it used for about $8 to $12. It is a fantastic resource. Fantastic resource, especially helping you appreciate the background of these passages and what's going on. It's just an outstanding resource. I highly, highly recommend it. I have no tie to the publisher. I don't get any kind of monetary or any other type of compensation for that recommendation. It's just a fantastic resource. There's not a book on that list that you'll get a bigger bang for your buck. Let me put it that way. There's not a book on this list that you'll get a bigger bang for your buck than the IVP Bible Background Commentary on the Old Testament. Finally, you've got your Brotherhood Commentaries, Gospel Advocate, Homer Haley, Kaufman, Living Word, the new one, Truth for Today, out of Searcy. Excellent resources. Again, I want to know what has been traditionally taught in the church so that if I end up saying something different, I need to make sure I've got a good biblical reason for doing so, dot my I's and cross my T's. Any comments or questions about any of this that we've discussed so far? All right, let's talk about delivering a lesson. Number one, it is impossible to over-prepare. It is impossible to over-prepare. I want you to imagine preparation of a lesson in terms of filling up a glass measuring cup. And so you're preparing. You're preparing. I want you to learn to prepare until you reach the point where you feel like you're ready. Is everybody following me? Okay. Prepare until you feel like you're ready, and then I want you to do a little bit more. Let's splash over the sides. At Fried Hardeman, they taught us that you preach and teach from the overflow. And I can't tell you what fantastic advice that is, because you never know when a little bit of extra preparation will help you answer a question that you were not anticipating, or it will give you some insight that you did not already have, or three, most valuable for me, it will give you a quote that says something better than you could have said yourself. So learn to over-prepare. How many of you are in any way, and please again raise your hand, if you can raise your hand, you're in great company. How many of you have any kind of anxiety or apprehension related to public speaking? Raise your hand. Okay, just about everybody. So, I'm going to give you a fantastic insight that's going to help you become a better public speaker. And do not feel bad, because survey after statistic after poll after survey has said that the number one fear among Americans is public speaking. The number two fear is death. That means that when it comes to a funeral, people would rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy. Explain that one to me. But let me give you some advice when it comes to overcoming fears of public speaking. Remember that preparation leads to confidence, and confidence leads to authority. So I'm sure that at least once y'all will let some young men do the service, maybe on a Sunday night, maybe you've listened to them give a talk, give a sermon. It's not always easy to give them your full and undivided attention. When those young boys give a talk, it's not always easy to give your full and undivided attention, because they have not yet learned to speak with confidence and authority, and you can't blame them, because that only comes with experience. On the other hand, we've listened to preachers before that we thought, wow, I could listen to that guy read the phone book. Have you heard these people? Okay, so what I want you to see here is that if you want to learn to become a speaker that can speak with confidence and authority and people willingly give you their attention, then you need to learn to over-prepare. Does this make sense to everybody? That over-preparation is going to lead to a sense of confidence inside of you, and that confidence is going to help you speak with authority. We have heard people speak before. Before they started speaking, we already knew that we were going to agree with everything they had to say, but they did not speak with confidence and authority, and it was a brutal experience, wasn't it? And yet again, we also know what it's like to listen to people that speak with a lot of confidence and authority, and it's a much more pleasurable experience. So if you want to overcome some of your issues related to public speaking, one of the things that I would strongly recommend is to over-prepare. And number two, practice until you can speak with few or no notes. Practice until you can speak with few or no notes. Ladies, if I were to ask you to tell me about your kids or your grandkids, you would not need notes for that conversation. Men, if I were to ask you to tell me about your family, your job, your hobbies, whatever, you would not need notes for that conversation. We do not need notes to speak intelligently and passionately about the things that matter to us. And I understand that all of us have jobs and families and responsibilities, and therefore it is not reasonable to ask you to teach every lesson from here on out without notes. That's not reasonable, week in and week out. But you can learn to speak with few notes, and that's my point. And especially I want to get you away from just being up here at the podium and you're just reading your notes off the page. That's what I want you to get away from. I love this statement that I came across one time. Personal ownership of what one teaches is the minimum requirement for effective teaching. I absolutely believe that to be the case. Personal ownership of what one teaches is the minimum requirement for effective teaching. When someone is up here and they're just kind of reading off a script, does it really seem like they own what they're saying? Usually not. So I want to get away from that. Learn to speak with few or no notes. Number three, remember that the goal is communication, not regurgitation. Remember that the goal is communication, not regurgitation. I want you to learn to triage your material into what is of primary and secondary importance. And remember that if you are a good teacher, you will always leave something on the table. This is probably something I see most often. Rookie, new teachers, inexperienced teachers, they fall into this trap of thinking that if I'm a good teacher, I'm going to get to everything that I had prepared. No, no. A good teacher, an experienced teacher, knows to leave something on the table. So you have your material that is of primary importance and then secondary importance. And as you're teaching, you're making sure to come back to these primary things regularly. But then the secondary stuff, that's what you're working in as you have time. That's what you're working in as you have time. And again, if you're a talented teacher, you don't get to everything that you have prepared. You're certainly getting to all the primary stuff, but you're only working in the secondary stuff as you have time. If my class ends up forgetting what talents and shekels equated to in a class on Naaman, I don't care. But if they end up forgetting that obedience precedes providence, now we have a problem. So again, learn that the goal is communication, not necessarily regurgitation of all the information you've given. Number four, use gestures. Use gestures. The joke on me is that if you tied my hands to my side, I couldn't talk. Use gestures. My dad was a big believer in gestures. And from the time that I was about 4.5, 5, 6 years old, he was training me to speak, to preach, and he was training me to use gestures. And that was one of the big things that he kept emphasizing over and over and over. Use gestures, use gestures, use gestures. Now, the funny thing about my dad did not preach anything like me. My dad preached from behind the pulpit, and he read his sermon as a manuscript every Sunday. He would write out his sermon word for word and print it out, size 20 Times New Roman font, and double spaced, and bounded a little booklet, and he would read through it, and he did an okay job, but he was such a big believer in gestures that he would script his gestures into his manuscript sermon so that when you'd see him pound the pulpit, you could read in his notes, weak point, pound pulpit. Use gestures. If you can't bring yourself to use gestures, it is perfectly acceptable to leave your hands at your side. That's completely acceptable. But the one thing you don't do is stick your hands in your pockets. Because what will you start doing with your hands in your pockets if you're not careful? You'll start rattling your change and your keys, your coins, and the people that are sitting in the front row, their heads will explode. So don't stick your hands in your pockets. That's one of the big, ultimate no-no rules when it comes to public speaking. Number five, eliminate filler words. What do I mean by filler words? And I would expand this to any obnoxious word or phrase that has made its way into your natural speaking pattern. Now, let me elaborate on this, and I want you to know that I am deadly serious when I go into this. People think I'm joking usually. I'm not joking. I'm deadly serious. I don't care who you are, you do not have the capacity to ask someone, what are some obnoxious words or phrases that I'm using? You don't have the capacity for them to answer that question and for you to buy in and believe what they're saying. If you ask someone, what are some obnoxious words or phrases that I'm using? And if they're dumb enough to answer, your response is going to be, oh, I don't say that. Or I don't say that that often. What you need to do instead is to find a way to record yourself speaking when you teach and then go back and listen to it. Listening to a recording of yourself speaking will make you a fantastic public speaker. It will also send you into years of therapy.
Amen.
Because listening to yourself speak is a horrific experience, but it'll make you a fantastic public speaker. So that's what I want to encourage you to do. A year ago, I was interviewed for a podcast with a friend, and I went back and listened to the podcast when it was published, and I noticed to my horror that I kept using the word certainly all the time in that interview, and it drove me nuts listening to it. And so I started trying to weed out the word certainly from my vocabulary when I spoke. Had a gentleman about a year ago, I was in Cookeville, Tennessee, and he came up to me after the seminar was over, and he said, I'm a member of the local Lions Club here in town, and there's a gentleman in our club that has a bad habit of saying the phrase, that kind of thing, all the time when he speaks. That kind of thing, that kind of thing, that kind of thing. And it's a joke with the rest of us in the Lions Club. When he gets up to speak and give a report in our meetings, we all take out a piece of paper or an envelope of some sort, and we write TKOT at the top, and we track them. He said one night he had 23 that kind of things in a 5-minute report. My speech professor in college told me this story when he was at Lipscomb in the late 80s. His speech professor had a bad habit of saying and all the time.
and it would drive the class crazy. He was in denial about it, and I would be too if I was a speech professor. So they recorded him on a cassette tape, and then they went back and they trimmed the tape down to all the uhs and ums, and they gave it to him. He had over 120 in a 50-minute lecture. He went and listened to the tape. He came back in the next class period. He had 3. Being aware of what you're saying is more than half the battle. All of us have obnoxious words and phrases that we are using in our natural speaking patterns, and we're oblivious to them, but we can catch everybody else's. And now for my favorite example. The very first time I did this seminar, I had a lady raise her hand and say, "You know, I find the phrase 'you know' to be very condescending and obnoxious." And I had to stifle my laughter because she had started her statement with, "You know, I find the phrase 'you know' to be very condescending and obnoxious." Everybody, the worst example, sometimes I share it, sometimes I don't, but I was in school with a guy. He was a good friend of mine. We did a lot of stuff together, but he had a horrible habit of prefacing every other sentence with this phrase, "I ain't gonna lie to you. I ain't gonna lie to you. I ain't gonna lie to you. I ain't gonna lie to you." And it would drive me nuts. I wanted to shake him. I said, "What is wrong with you? Stop saying that. Stop saying that. Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. You're not a used car salesman. I ain't even gonna lie to you. Come on now." So I'm telling you, all of us have these obnoxious words or phrases. I love it when I'm talking to someone and been about maybe after 15, 20, 30 minutes of talking to them, they'll use the phrase, "Can I be honest with you?" I'm thinking, "Hey, have you been lying to me this whole time?" So try to figure out what are these obnoxious words or phrases that you're using and try to cut them out. Do not depend on someone else to tell you. You will not believe them, even if they're dumb enough to tell you the answer. There's something about having to stare in the face that cold, hard reality, that objective evidence of the tape. Do y'all know what I'm saying? There's something about having to stare that cold, hard evidence in the face that helps us weed this stuff out. Number 6, you have my permission to have one soapbox for every class. You need to have one soapbox for every class. This is the advice that when I was in New Zealand, they would always ask me, "What's a soapbox?" And I would have to explain it to them. Here's what I mean. There needs to be that one part of your lesson that you're looking forward to more than anything else. There needs to be one part of your lesson that you are really looking forward to, because you know that when you get there, your adrenaline is going to start pumping and your blood's going to start flowing and you're going to get really excited and you're going to start clicking on all 4 cylinders and the sun's going to come down and shine and the clouds are going to part and God's going to be up on his throne going, "Shh, this is going to be good." It needs to be that one part of your lesson that you're looking forward to more than anything else, because it will give your lesson an energy and a rhythm and a tempo that it would not ordinarily have. We have all sat in on lessons and sermons and thought to ourselves, "We're not going anywhere fast anytime soon." Okay? But we've also sat through lessons and sermons, and after it was over, it's like, "Wow, that was incredible. And I can't believe it lasted 2 hours, and there's no way that we're beating the Baptist to the buffet today, but hey, that was a good lesson," you know? So again, I want you to have that one part of your lesson that you're looking forward to more than anything else. Don't have more than one, or you will wear your audience out, and you'll wear yourself out. Some of us have heard sermons and lessons that were, it was a very intense emotional experience. Have y'all ever heard sermons and lessons that were just, it was very emotional? You know, it was a sad story, or it touched us, it was an intense emotional experience, and you were emotionally worn out. I would venture to say that for many of those types of lessons, to this day, you can scarcely remember anything about what the lesson was about. All you remember is that you were emotionally worn out when it was over. I don't want that to happen. So I want to have one soapbox, and that's it. Any more than that, and you will wear your audience out. Finally, number 7, you need to pray. Prayer needs to be the first and the last thing that you do as part of a preparation and delivery of a lesson. And I would dare say that a lesson that has not been prayed over probably shouldn't be presented. Comments or questions about anything we've talked about? All right, let's think about it. Oh, yes, sir.
Part of my job, I have to interview people.
I'm sorry.
One thing that Can I be honest with you? Please do so.
Here. Again, we have these phrases that we've used them, and we don't ever mean them literally, but they can still be obnoxious sometimes to other people. So, great, yeah. All right, let's